Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role do stem cells play in human bodies, and how is their function directed and regulated over the course of a lifetime? The debate over the experimental value of embryonic stem cells generates a lot of media attention, but our bodies contain stem cells from before we're born until the day we die, and the gradual decline in their regenerative function as we age may be a sort of trade-off that reduces our chances of developing certain kinds of cancer. Dr. Sean Morrison joins us to talk about new research. He's professor of pediatrics at UT Southwestern Medical Center and director of the Children's Medical Center Research Institute. His most recent research findings are published in the March 9th issue of the journal Nature. He joins us today as part of KERA's Breakthroughs Initiative. Sean, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris.
So let's start at the beginning for us. What is a stem cell exactly, and what makes it so different from other kinds of cells that can divide and reproduce in the body?
Yes, great question. Stem cells are the cells in each tissue that give rise to all of the other cells. So they're the cells that form our tissues during fetal development, and then they're the cells that maintain those tissues throughout your life. So they give rise to all of the other specialized cells. So for example, we all have stem cells in your bone marrow that make new blood cells every day. So if you think about the red blood cells and the immune system cells that are floating around in your blood, they arise from stem cells and have to be maintained. Similarly, you have stem cells in your skin that make new skin cells. We have many different kinds of stem cells in different tissues that repair those tissues and replace the cells that turn over.
So you focused a lot in your career on those stem cells in the bone marrow that make immune system cells and blood cells, and also on nerve cells. Can you talk about why the sort of combination of those different kinds of stem cells is interesting?
By going back and forth between stem cells in different tissues, we learn a lot more about what properties are shared by stem cells in different tissues. So it's like anything else. If you have only one example of how something works, you assume that the other examples are the same way. Whereas if you have two examples, you know geometrically more about the properties and how they can be similar or different between different tissues. So there's actually, we've known for a very long time that there were stem cells in the bone marrow that replaced your blood cells. But there's also a population of stem cells in your brain that makes certain kinds of new brain cells that turn over on a regular basis.
Do stem cells renew themselves through a different mechanism than other kinds of cells?
Yeah, that's a great question. They do. My laboratory, the central focus historically has been, I guess I should say, first of all, that your ability to maintain your tissues depends on your ability to maintain stem cells throughout life in most tissues. There are some tissues that turn over more than others. Not all of our tissues have stem cells, but many do. And your capacity to maintain those stem cells depends on the ability of the stem cells to replicate themselves. We call it self-renewing divisions, where stem cells divide to make more stem cells. And we've studied the molecular mechanisms that underlie that ability. And sure enough, we find that stem cells do that in a different way than more specialized cells. So you have some specialized cells that can't replicate themselves at all, and other specialized cells that have a limited capacity to replicate themselves. Stem cells differ in part because they have a massive capacity to replicate themselves. And part of the reason why people get so excited about stem cells in the context of regenerative medicine is because they have the capacity to make massive numbers of specialized cells. And as a result, can repair tissues after major injuries or regenerate tissues that need to be regenerated.
So that ability does decline over time as we get older, right? So in other words, if you have a broken arm when you're 9, you're better in 6 weeks. And if you have it when you're 69, you might really be out of commission for a matter of months.
Yeah, exactly right. We all know that it's a fundamental characteristic of the aging process that we take longer to heal the older that we get. And, you know, I think there was a time when people thought, well, that makes sense. Stuff wears out as it gets older. And so presumably stem cells wear out too. And there's some truth to that, but as we've studied the underlying molecular mechanisms, it's more interesting than that. The stem cells are actively shutting themselves down as we get older. And we think they're probably shutting themselves down to avoid turning into cancer cells. Hmm. Because the older we get, the more genetic damage accumulates in our cells and the higher the risk we are of getting cancer. And we think that one of the major places that the genetic damage accumulates over time is in the stem cells that are within our tissues. And so by turning on certain kinds of molecular mechanisms in the context of aging, the stem cells shut themselves down. The good news is that that allows us to get older before we get cancer. The bad news is that it makes us older by reducing the regenerative capacity of our tissues. So it's a trade-off.
So what you want is essentially the ideal balance between those functions.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a little bit hard to know what the ideal balance is because the ideal balance may be different in the context of an injury mm-hmm. where you really, really need regeneration than in a situation where you're not injured and it's okay for the stem cells just to kind of keep going at a low level.
How are stem cells programmed and sort of told what to do throughout the course of a lifetime?
One of the things that we've discovered, we've been working on this problem for about 15 years, and one of the things we discovered is that stem cells use different mechanisms to replicate themselves at different stages of life. And if you think about it, it makes sense because during fetal development, when the tissues are growing like crazy, the stem cells are just dividing as fast as they can to produce new tissues. As you move into young adulthood now, there's no more net growth in your tissue, but the stem cells have to be of a certain level of activity to regenerate the cells that turn over due to wear and tear and the ability to quickly repair tissues that become injured. As you move into old age, now when you start to become at greatest risk of cancer, now, as I said before, the stem cells start to shut themselves down, probably in order to avoid turning into cancer cells. And so so the way in which the stem cells change their properties over time in response to the changing growth and regeneration demands of tissues and in response to the changing risk of cancer is that the molecular mechanisms that they use to replicate themselves also change over time. And that's part of why your tissues can grow really, really quickly during fetal development, why we no longer have net growth as adults, but we repair ourselves quickly as young adults, and why we have less capacity to repair tissues as old adults.
So we also have these substances in the body known as tumor suppressors. Can you explain what those are and where they come from?
Tumor suppressors are a class of genes that negatively regulate the survival or proliferation of cells. And they're called tumor suppressors because these are the genes that get turned on when a cell is worried that it's turning into a cancer cell. So basically, these are a way of shutting a cell to shut itself down when it's afraid that it's turning into a cancer cell. And some of these tumor suppressor mechanisms are not on in young adult stem cells, but they come on in old adult stem cells. We and some of our colleagues first noticed that these genes were coming on in the context of aging and shutting stem cell function down. So if we prevented these genes from coming on in the context of aging, we could increase the regenerative capacity of aging tissues. But the cost was that the mice started developing more cancers at an early age. And that's part of the reason we know that there's a trade-off here. And so as we age, this is what's happening to our tissues. We're balancing the need to repair them with the risk of cancer that's associated with greater repair capacity.
So there are two types of tumor suppressors, right? There are gatekeeping cells or gatekeeping tumor suppressors, and then there are caretaking tumor suppressors.
Boy, you're good, Chris. Holy cow.
I just do my research.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that distinction is important because caretaking tumor suppressors are involved in activities like ensuring the integrity of our genetic material. So we had the blueprints for our cells are the chromosomes, the DNA that we have, mm-hmm. and that can become corrupted over time. Like, for example, ultraviolet light from the sun can cause skin cancer in part by corrupting the DNA that's present in skin-forming stem cells.
So that damage from the sun is what ultimately makes it possible for skin tumors to grow.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And we have a whole set of mechanisms inside our cells to try to combat that, to try to repair, for example, the lesions that can occur in the DNA in response to sun or chemicals that can cause genetic damage. And so those are caretaking tumor suppressors, and those are active throughout life, and we need them to be active throughout life. And there are some human diseases that are associated with a premature aging where part of what goes wrong in those diseases is that those caretaking tumor suppressor mechanisms are damaged or not as active as they normally are. Then there's what are called gatekeeping tumor suppressors, which are like the fail-safe mechanisms that I was referring to earlier, mechanisms that turn on in a cell to shut it down when it becomes concerned that it could turn into a cancer cell.
And that might actually be happening even among those of us walking around with no evidence of cancerous disease. Our bodies might be protecting us at all times from the odd cancer cell here or there.
Our bodies are protecting us at all times in many different ways. You know, we have relatively long lifespans among other animals, and so our bodies have to do a better job of protecting us from cancer as a consequence. And some of those mechanisms act at the molecular level, like these tumor suppressors that we're talking about, and there are many mechanisms that act at the cellular level, like our immune systems are detecting abnormal cells that arise all the time in the body and killing them off.
Is it possible to test people for their levels of things like tumor suppressors in order to predict disease before it's occurred?
It is. So a colleague of mine, Norman Sharpless at the University of North Carolina, along with us, co-discovered this observation that a particular tumor suppressor called P16 or INC4A is probably one of the best biomarkers of aging that we have. And as a consequence of Ned's work, it's clear that the rate at which people are aging biologically seems to correlate with the level at which P16 is turned on. And so he's shown that people that smoke, P16 comes on more quickly. People that exercise, it comes on more slowly. So there's an inherited genetic program. A programmed obsolescence that we all are born with that means that none of us are going to live forever, that, you know, we're going to age, everybody ages, but you can slightly accelerate or decelerate that program as a result of environmental exposures like smoking, exercise, sunlight, these kinds of things.
And at this point, lifestyle, those are the changes that we have control over, right? It's not as if you can see that someone is aging prematurely and say, here, take this pill, let me give you this shot, and we'll fix everything.
Yeah, we really have very little capacity to intervene with, I'd say, the fundamental aspects of aging pharmacologically. Now, there are certain diseases that are associated with aging that we're starting to learn how to intervene in. So, for example, heart disease is something that's very much associated with aging, and we've really been able to have an impact on heart disease with statins, drugs that reduce our ability to make cholesterol and therefore slow the rate at which we develop atherosclerosis as a result of work done at UT Southwestern.
And then there are other diseases that affect us because, say, our joints don't work as well as they used to. And that's, again, a process of degenerative activity within the body?
Yeah.
Or the lack of regenerative activity?
It's both. Mm-hmm. There are elements of regeneration that are not as robust and therefore, you know, we don't grow back bone and actually cartilage does not regenerate well at all in our bodies under most circumstances. And so, you know, part of arthritis or those kinds of changes arise as a result of wear and tear.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Sean Morrison. He's professor of pediatrics at UT Southwestern Medical Center and director of the Children's Research Institute. We're talking about stem cells, aging, lifelong health. You're welcome to join us at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Sean Morrison. He is director of the Children's Research Institute and professor of pediatrics at UT Southwestern Medical Center. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So let's talk about the research published this month in the journal Nature. What you discovered was that blood-forming stem cells, which is what you've been studying, require a highly regulated synthesis of protein. Give us that in layman's terms and help us understand why it's important.
Yeah, let me back up and explain why this is interesting. Much of what we know about what happens at a molecular level during aging comes from studies on what are called model organisms. It's hard to study aging in humans because it takes a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so what scientists do is they study oftentimes worms and flies.
Short lifespan.
Only live for about a month. And so there are many, many experiments that can be done. But what's been learned from those experiments is that the molecular mechanisms that regulate aging in worms and flies are extraordinarily similar and, you know, to a first approximation, evolutionarily conserved in humans. And so one of the things that was learned from those studies in model organisms was this initially very surprising observation that the more protein you make, the shorter your lifespan. The less protein your cells make, the longer your lifespan. So genetic changes that increase protein production reduce lifespan.
Let me stop you. Is that from individual to individual or from species to species?
That's individual to individual. So the way those experiments were done was by introducing genetic changes into worms or flies initially and showing that you would increase the fly's or worm's lifespan by reducing the amount of protein it makes. Mm-hmm. And probably that relates to a quality control process inside the cells. So many of your traits and, in fact, your traits and the ability of your cells to operate is determined by the proteins that you make. So we all know that our traits are encoded in DNA, but the way that our DNA builds cells and regulates their ability to operate is by specifying the structures of the proteins that you make. Some proteins are building blocks, you know, collagen in your skin, that's a protein. And some proteins are enzymes. So when you think about metabolism and all your metabolic enzymes, that's all being run by proteins. And for a protein to behave properly and to have a correct function, it has to attain the proper structure. And so there's a process by which the cells make proteins, and then they have to fold the proteins. And it turns out that if a cell tries to make proteins more quickly than it's really prepared to do, then the proteins can become misfolded and can gum up the works and cause damage inside the cells. And there are some kinds of diseases, like Alzheimer's disease, which we know is caused by the misfolding of proteins over time that accumulate in brain cells and ultimately kill those brain cells. And it's not the only disease. So people have thought of this as something that happens on an organismal-wide basis to influence how long you live. But no one had ever been able to study it in stem cells, in part because of the tools that are required to study the production of protein have been tools that you couldn't use in individual cells. You had to use large numbers of cells, like whole organs or growing cells in dishes in the laboratory. So we adapted some techniques that were originally developed in Adrian Salich's laboratory at Harvard University to make it possible to study the production of protein in individual stem cells inside of mice. And we were very surprised to learn that that different cells are making protein on very different scales, even within the blood-forming system, that the cells that are the shortest-lived in the blood-forming system are cranking out huge amounts of protein. So they're living fast and dying young. And the stem cells, which have to last for years to maintain the blood-forming system, are making protein at a slower rate than any other cells. So that paper was exciting, partly because we showed for the first time that it was possible to study the process of protein synthesis in stem cells, and this opens up a whole new world of biology to exploration, understanding how different cells do it differently. But also in this, in the context of this literature on aging biology, this paper suggests that what we knew was true at the level of whole organisms, that is, the more protein you make, the shorter you live, might also be true at the level of individual cells. And that one of the ways that stem cells – one of the things that stem cells might need to do, our data suggest that they do need to produce protein at a low rate in order to persist throughout life in our tissues.
So, Sean, does medical science have any control over the rate at which individual cells produce proteins, or any ideas as to how this might be done in the future?
Yeah, there are ways of having an impact on this. Let me give you two examples. There's a drug called rapamycin, which was first developed as an immunosuppressant drug in patients that had received transplants to control immune system activation. Well, one of the main effects of this drug is to reduce the rate at which you make protein. And a former colleague of mine at the University of Michigan, Rich Miller, showed that if you feed mice rapamycin, they live longer. And that's part of the reason we know that these mechanisms related linking protein production with lifespan are evolutionarily conserved.
And they live longer even in the absence of any obvious disease?
Yeah, I think it requires more study to assess the extent to which modulating protein synthesis influences disease risk and the risk of diseases associated with aging. But we certainly know that it does have an effect on the maximum lifespan in a way that's not obviously explained by changes in cancer risk, for example.
All right. And I'm sorry, you said there were two ideas.
Yeah. So even more directly tying this to protein synthesis, he showed that he could accomplish the same thing by feeding the mice a low methionine diet. So methionine is an amino acid, a building block for proteins. And so if you give the mice low levels of methionine in their diet, it impedes their ability to make protein.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also join us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Doug in Rockwall. Hi, Doug.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Professor Morrison. How are you?
Great.
Well, I've got a question. The longer that I'm out of school, and I finished my undergraduate studies over 30 years ago, but it's the people that I remember most. It's students and professors. And the one that I'm thinking about right now had an extraordinarily sharp mind deep into his 80s. And here's my question for you. The facts are Dr. Phillips, he was a history professor. He got his terminal degree at Harvard. He was a fine gentleman. He was a slight build, maybe 115 pounds. But the man walked 2 miles to and from work every day for 35 years. I mean, unless it was a pouring thunderstorm. And my question for you is this. He was a teetotaler, and he knew even back then that any consumption of alcohol would kill his brain cells. So he did a lot of healthy things. And my specific question is this. Was Dr. Phillips unwittingly assisting his own stem cells by oxygenating his cells and was never overweight and was a teetotaler? Was he just lining up his later years to have a very alacrity of mind, even until the year or so before he passed away? He died just a couple of years ago.
Any thoughts?
There are a lot of factors that determine the rate at which people age and their susceptibility to age-related diseases, and stem cells are just one component of all of that. But it certainly sounds like he had a number of healthy habits that would be beneficial across the spectrum. Alcohol, you know, in small quantities is not a problem, but it's in moderate or larger quantities is not good for you. It increases your risk of cancer and various other diseases depending on how much you consume. Exercise is really good for you. Another evolutionarily conserved contributor to aging is what's essentially energy balance inside your cells. If you're taking in more energy through your diet, more calories than you actually burn, and putting on weight, that's really bad in a number of levels, right down to your cellular level. Whereas exercise, when the cells start to burn more energy than they're taking in, that is incredibly healthy in a lot of different ways inside the cells. And so exercise is good, and some of the effects of things like alcohol consumption and exercise may occur at the level of stem cells, but they're also occurring at the level of other kinds of cells. So, for example, you know, your ability to be mentally alert with age. There are genetic factors that have a huge impact on this, and stem cells are probably a small contribution in that case because our brain doesn't turn over and regenerate the way some other tissues like our liver and our blood-forming system do. And so the cells inside our brain, the neurons that are responsible for transmitting signals and our ability, largely responsible for our ability to think, they really have to make sure that they keep their DNA in good working order and their protein production in good working order so you don't gum up the works in those cells in particular.
Is it only stem cells that can generate cancer cells?
No. We think that stem cells are a major site where genetic damage accumulates over time, in part because they have a long lifespan. We have some cells that turn over very quickly. Your skin cells and many of your blood cells don't last very long. They last a matter of weeks and then they die. And so you're not going to accumulate genetic damage in those cells over a period of years. Whereas if your stem cells are present for years and years, they could be a site where you accumulate damage. But then even if the damage is accumulating in the stem cells, the final hit that really pushes the cell over the edge and turns it into a full-blown cancer cell could occur either in the stem cells themselves or in the specialized progeny of the stem cells. Mm-hmm. And so different cancers probably arise in some cases from stem cells, in some cases from the specialized cells. But in many cases, much of the damage is probably accumulating over time in the stem cells.
Is there a difference in the behavior of the cancer depending on where those cancer cells come from?
Really good question. And I think we don't know the answer to that question yet. It's difficult to address experimentally. I suspect the answer is yes, but it remains to be tested.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Chris in Grapevine. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well,
thanks.
I'm
thoroughly enjoying the conversation.
Great.
I had a question. When Dr. Morrison was speaking earlier about the stem cells shutting cells down to prevent them from turning to cancer, I got very curious. I have a genetic condition called Cowden syndrome. My body is missing the gene that tells it to quit growing cells, and I wondered if the stem cells are controlled genetically. Or I thought maybe he could explore that a little bit.
Thanks for your call.
Stem cells are controlled genetically, and Cowden syndrome is caused by a loss of function genetic defect in a tumor suppressor gene that regulates signals inside the cell that promote survival and proliferation. And so one of the symptoms of Cowden's disease is the development of usually benign tumors in a variety of tissues that arise as a result of stem cells proliferating more than they should. And you're at an increased risk of cancer when you have Cowden's disease, in part because the gene that's mutated, the tumor suppressor that's mutated in Cowden's disease, is one of the main tumor suppressors that protects us from cancer.
So does that suggest that theoretically Cowden syndrome is something that could be helped by ongoing research into the function of stem cells?
Yeah, there's a lot of research that's going on in that area. In fact, in my laboratory, we study that gene that's involved in Cowden's disease. And, you know, the way these kinds of molecular mechanisms operate in cells is very, very complicated. And, you know, people thought they knew how it worked to a certain extent 5-10 years ago. And the more we study it, the more complicated it gets. And, you know, at one level, that's a hard thing. And it's part of the reason why It's not easy to cure diseases. It's really, really complicated, and we have to do a tremendous amount of research. But on the other hand, it also creates therapeutic opportunities when you start to realize that different cells use these mechanisms in different ways. It gives us a way of intervening.
I think members of the general public who are not scientists hear about stem cell therapies and they think, great, well, at some point you'll learn how to sort of inject a stem cell into an organ that's having a problem and you fix it. Clearly, it's much more complicated than that. But is there a reason to be concerned that experimentation with stem cells could leave experimental patients more susceptible to certain kinds of cancers?
Great question. And there, stem cell research has enormous promise. And we do believe that there will be new cures developed as a result of stem cell research. But as you pointed out, there's a tremendous amount, even when our ideas are correct about which cells we can use to treat effectively, you know, which disease. It takes a tremendous amount of research in order to figure out how to do that safely and effectively. And, you know, one of the things that people have to be careful about in this area is that there is this strong sense in the general public that stem cells equals cure. But people in the general public often don't understand how many years of research are required to get to that point. And unfortunately, there are snake oil salesmen that have launched for-profit clinics, particularly in countries with unregulated medical systems, promising to cure any number of diseases with stem cell therapies. And you know, I mean that with air quotes around the stem cell therapies, because oftentimes at best, what they're selling is unproven, and in many cases, just out and out fraud. And there are large numbers of Americans who are traveling overseas to these clinics, desperate patients whose hopes are being preyed upon by the people in these clinics, offering implausible therapies, you know, with the promise of a cure. So people should be very cautious about traveling outside of countries with regulated medical care systems. And there are hundreds and hundreds of clinical trials that are currently going on with stem cell therapies in the United States at reputable institutions, and that's a really good thing. But if people are going to engage in a trial, they should do it with proper regulatory oversight in a creditable academic institution.
We're speaking with Dr. Sean Morrison, professor of pediatrics and director of the Children's Research Institute at UT Southwestern Medical Center. We'll resume the conversation in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Sean Morrison joins us today as part of KERA's Breakthroughs Initiative. His work appears in the March 9th, 2014 issue of the journal Nature. He's professor of pediatrics and director of the Children's Research Institute at the UT Southwestern Medical Center. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So we were talking about this further during the break, and you were saying that there's actually a problem, particularly in border states, with desperate patients sort of being recruited by unscrupulous medical practitioners.
In fact, there have been people arrested and put in jail in Dallas and in other parts of Texas for recruiting patients to go across the border to clinics in Mexico who are offering bogus stem cell therapies that they claim will cure incurable diseases. And there are significant numbers of desperate Americans who can't be treated effectively with the therapies that we have, who go to these clinics, you know, in a last-ditch effort. But in fact, it is very, very rare for therapies to be available outside of the United States that have been tested enough to know that they're safe and effective, but yet are not available yet in the United States. The medical research system in the United States is the best in the world. So usually therapies become available here first. And so if your doctor doesn't have reason to believe that a therapy will be safe and effective for you, it's probably not.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Ann in Dallas. Hi, Ann.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Morrison, welcome to Texas. A lot of people in the pediatric cancer community have kind of heralded your work at University of Michigan. Certainly, we're grateful to the Taubman family for their support of stem cell research. But what we're struggling with locally is a disconnect between UT Southwestern and Children's Medical Center Dallas. And how are you, with your title in pediatrics, really ensuring that we're pushing the stem cell research on the clinical side, not to the clinical side, but incorporating and really utilizing the resources at Children's Medical Center Dallas when we have an environment where oftentimes, you know, physicians really got to get in there and see those patients, but yet the research isn't coming out of UT Southwestern as it relates specifically to pediatrics?
Well, Children's Medical Center and UT Southwestern work very closely together. The ties between these institutions are really extensive. The physicians that see patients at Children's Medical Center are faculty in the Department of Pediatrics at UT Southwestern, and there are multiple joint ventures that have been launched between these institutions to try to not only deliver care in an innovative way, but also to stimulate research in areas where we currently don't have the technology to cure children. So Children's Research Institute that I direct is just one example where Children's Medical Center has funded this joint venture with UT Southwestern. The institute is located on the UT Southwestern campus, and the money to create the institute comes from Children's Medical Center. This is their investment in cutting-edge biomedical research. But the people who work in the institute will all be UT Southwestern employees. Just one example, along with the Department of Pediatrics, about the extensive interactions between these institutions. And, you know, Children's Medical Center is one of the great children's hospitals in the country. UT Southwestern is one of the world's great medical schools. So Dallas is very fortunate to have these institutions and to have them working together.
Given the process that you described earlier with adult cancers of the sort of suppression of tumors as opposed to the activity of stem cells, is there a very different mechanism at work in the most common pediatric cancers?
I think I mentioned earlier that stem cells use different mechanisms over time to replicate themselves, and that cancer cells hijack those mechanisms to enable tumor formation. Well, what that means is if stem cells use different mechanisms over time, that means that cancer cells would have to hijack different mechanisms over time. And so we've looked at this in the laboratory, and it's been known for some time that if you compare the same kind of cancer in an adult population versus a pediatric population, that the genetic defects, the mutations that cause the cancer, are different between children and adult. And we think it's because the stem cells, there's different mechanisms that regulate cellular replication over time in children versus adult, and therefore there's different mechanisms that are competent to cause cancer at different times. So as we understand the underlying biology here, it creates new ideas for how we could most effectively intervene and most effectively customize therapies for children versus adults. And this is one example. Sometimes people ask me, well, you direct a children's research institute. You know, why would you be interested in aging? There's two important points here. One is that the things that happen in the context of aging represent processes that got started even during fetal development and during childhood. And you really have to understand the whole picture in order to understand the biology. And many times the treatments that we use in children started out with research in adults and vice versa. So we're trying to understand the biology in a holistic way with the hope of then intervening and developing new therapies.
Is it a radical moment in the body when our stem cells decide we have completed our growth?
There are radical changes within your tissues between childhood and adulthood, you know, while you're growing versus when you stop growing. Mm-hmm. Changes at the molecular level, at the cellular level, and you really need to – everything has to run differently in those mm-hmm. contexts.
We've had several questions via email about cord blood storage and what you think about that and how it works.
Umbilical cord blood is a great source of blood-forming stem cells, and it's used clinically to restore the blood-forming system in patients that have been treated for various kinds of diseases. So some kinds of cancer therapies, particular therapies for blood-forming cancers, involve wiping out the blood-forming system, and then to regenerate it, you have to transplant new blood-forming stem cells in. It used to be that this was all done by bone marrow transplantation. People are familiar with bone marrow transplants. Well, the active ingredient in a bone marrow transplant is blood-forming stem cells. And increasingly, people are getting them not from bone marrow, but from other sources like umbilical cord blood. So it's a very good thing to bank umbilical cord blood. Although what actually works best are public cord blood banks, where people, when they give birth, would just donate their cord blood, and then it would be stored in a public bank for whoever needs it later on. There are private companies that will charge people a lot of money to store their own cord blood, but the statistics show that your chances of needing your child's chances of needing their cord blood later is probably less than their chances of being hit by lightning. Hmm. And so the money that you would put into private cord blood banking might be better invested in a college fund.
And there's no cost to joining one of these public blood banks, or how does that work, or cord blood banks?
That's right. Although the public cord blood banks are limited in size, and so I do know some people that have wanted to do that and have had trouble finding a bank that wanted their sample. For a variety of reasons. But I think the take-home message is that for public health purposes, the best solution really is to increase the size of these blood banks. And right now, these banks probably have quite a lot of samples that are a match for people of European descent. But where we really, really struggle is people of, say, South Asian and African descent, where there's more genetic diversity in those populations and where historically those people are not as represented among bone marrow registries or in blood banks. And so it's a lot harder for people of Asian or African descent to find a match if they need a transplant, whether it's from cord blood or bone marrow or another organ. Because we have to – one of the things we know about transplantation biology is that you can't just randomly transplant most tissues from one person into another. You have to match their immune systems. Because if we were to take – one of your tissues and transplanted into me, my immune system would recognize it as foreign mm-hmm. and would kill it. And so to get that match, you're most likely to get that either within the same family or at minimum in people that have a common ancestry. And so Children's Medical Center, for example, has programs with bone marrow drives or where people can register and have their genetic background assessed to be just kept on file in case somebody ever needs a transplant like bone marrow, umbilical cord blood that could be a match.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Adam in Dallas. Hi, Adam.
Hey, thank you so much for everything you're doing. It's exciting and gives us all something to look forward to in the future. My question is pretty practical. Yesterday, I sent my wife to UT Southwestern for her preventive physical that we get for free every year. And I sent her with a checklist of the physical done at the Cooper Institute, which we're also fortunate to have here because it was rated top 10 best physicals in the U.S. at one time. And anyways, we can't afford the Cooper Institute. It's not on our insurance. UT Southwestern is. And so we, you know, because of all the exciting stuff you guys do, we choose it as the best option that we can afford. And I'm just curious, how much of this new stuff you're talking about, slowing down the aging process, and how much of it we can expect, you know, that those of us that are just on insurance and can't afford to pay a large amount of cash to see, like, at UT Southwestern in the future in our preventive physicals.
Most of the stuff that I'm talking about is not stuff that you would be discussing with a primary care physician during a routine physical at this point. Most of the stuff that I've been talking about relates to research that's being done now. In some cases, there are clinical trials that are being done to assess the extent to which it can benefit patients, but it'll take a while to progress through those clinical trials before we know what's safe and what's effective so that it can be incorporated into routine medical care. I should say, though, that one of the strategies in Children's Research Institute is to integrate the science that we do with the routine delivery of care. And this also speaks to the issue that came up earlier about collaboration between Children's Medical Center and UT Southwestern. We've recently launched a program within our institute called Genetic and Metabolic Disease, led by a UT Southwestern professor in Children's Research Institute named Ralph DeBaradinas. And there are kids who are born with what are called inborn errors of metabolism, where they have a genetic defect that makes their metabolism not work right. And these kids can develop chemical imbalances as a result of these medical defects that have to be detected when they're very young. And there are some of these defects that are routine to detect, and there are tests that are performed when kids are born to
heel stick, that sort of thing.
The heel stick, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so Ralph is the guy in this part of Dallas who examines those heel stick tests and follows up with the kids with abnormal results. But there's a lot of these kids that have abnormal results and where there's good reason to believe they have inborn errors of metabolism, but where they can't be diagnosed with existing tests. There are many ways in which metabolism can go wrong. And so one of the things that we're doing within the institute is developing the capacity to sequence the genetic material of these kids, to examine their metabolic pathways in a broad manner, and then to try to integrate those sources of information in a way that nobody has integrated before in an attempt to diagnose kids that currently go undiagnosed. And if we can succeed in doing that, then there will not only be kids out there who become diagnosable and will be able to treat more effectively, but we'll be able to learn scientifically from those kids because we may be able to learn something new about how the metabolic pathways work in our body. And it illustrates how we're really going back and forth between the science that's done in the institute and the clinical programs at Children's Medical Center.
How does funding work for the research you do? What's the balance between, say, government funding and philanthropic, and I don't know if you get private industry money?
The basic funding for the institute comes from Children's Medical Center and donors to Children's Medical Foundation. And we use that money to create the institute and to recruit new faculty. We're trying to recruit the best young scientists in the country to Dallas. But most of the money that goes to pay for the actual science that's done in the institute comes from extramural grants from organizations like the National Institutes of Health, private philanthropies like the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and the Cancer Prevention and Research Institute of Texas.
Dr. Sean Morrison is professor of pediatrics at UT Southwestern Medical Center and director of the Children's Research Institute there. His findings on stem cells appear in the March 9th issue of the journal Nature. Sean, it's been a real pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Great talking to you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phone today from Katie Daniel. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.